The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A Buddhist teacher from Thailand come who basically said that Buddhism is all about food. And what he meant was, by food, what he meant was food of the mind, Dharma food. And that the food we take in, the Dharma food we take in, conditions our mind, and we can make our mind, condition our mind so that it becomes suitable for both Dharma practice, but more importantly, what he said, make our mind suitable so that we can be a benefit for others, be benefit for ourselves and benefit for others. And so it takes some care then what we take in. And it also involves taking some responsibility for what conditions our mind. And that was kind of the topic today, was I wanted to this idea of taking responsibility for what conditions our mind, our hearts, is a big part of Buddhism. And it's built on the foundation of an insight that the Buddha had, and the insight that our experience, especially our inner experience, is dependently arisen, or dependently co-arisen, that our psychological life, our inner life, our spiritual life, our fundamental happiness or suffering arises because of causes and conditions. And as those causes and conditions change, our suffering or happiness can change as well. And that part of emphasis in Buddhism is that we can take some responsibility for those causes and conditions for ourselves. And we're not necessarily just the victims of fate, victims of what happens around us, but we have a huge say in taking responsibility for the stream or the flow of conditions that impact or shape our happiness. And as the monk said last night, not only our happiness, but our ability to then to be of service to others, to bring benefit to others. What I'd like to do is to go back to the time of the Buddha and contextualize this teaching that he came up with in the times that he taught. And do it with the story of Sariputta. Sariputta was the Buddha's kind of senior-most student, a disciple, kind of sometimes said to be his right-hand monk, and or sometimes called the general of the Dharma. And second to the Buddha, he was probably the person who had most influence in shaping what Buddhism has become down through the ages. A lot of teachings are preserved by Sariputta. And the story goes that Sariputta had a best friend. They were born in the same town, grew up together. And at some point, they went to a festival, a multi-day festival. And they participated the first day or so with the festival. And on the second day, they took a break from the festival and went kind of across a little dale or valley, I suppose, and were kind of from a distance watching the festival happening. And it's very interesting sometimes to be a little bit removed from something that we were kind of enmeshed in. If you've ever been on a gone out in a balcony and closed the glass doors when the party's going on inside or the argument's going on inside, you can see what's going on, but you don't quite feel like you're entangled with it. And so there's a kind of different perspective that can happen. So they were across the valley looking at the festival, and they both had their understanding that in 100 years, none of this would exist. All the partying and celebrating and all these activities were ephemeral. They were there temporarily. And perhaps to invest all your interest, all the motivation, the activity of your life on something that ephemeral and be gone in 100 years, they saw it as being maybe not such, it wasn't really worthwhile, it wasn't really a worthwhile pursuit. So for these two gentlemen, it was an insight that changed the direction of what they were interested in doing with their life. And I think many people will find at some point in their lives there's a turning point where what interests a person, what motivates them, what seems really important, no longer is that case, and people then turn towards something else. What else? What's really meaningful in this life of ours? What really is deeply important to do, maybe for myself or maybe for the world around me? And so then became interested in something else besides partying, besides going to a festival, or I don't know what else they did. And so they went around to visit some of the spiritual teachers of their time, and they became a disciple of a particular teacher. And at some point, a Buddhist monk came to town, and they'd never seen one. And so Sariputta went to the Buddhist monk and said, "You know, who are you, and what are you? What's your game? And what does your teacher teach?" And the monk said, "I'm a new monk. I'm not really qualified to say what the Buddha teaches." And Sariputta said, "Well, you know, I'm kind of smart. And why don't you just give me a little kind of hint or a little summary of what the Buddha had to teach, and maybe I'll kind of get a sense of it from that." And so the monk said this. He said, "Of those things that arise from a cause, the Buddha teaches the cause and the cessation of that cause." That's it. That was the hint. And with that hint, Sariputta's Dharma eye opened. Is some kind of deep insight, deep understanding from that hint. He went back to his friend Mogliana, because they made a pact after the festival. They made a pact saying, if one of us discovers the truth first, we'll come and tell the other. So he went to Mogliana, his friend, and he said, "There's this guy, his teacher, who teaches that whatever has a cause, he teaches what the cause is and the cessation of that cause." And his eye opened up. So why would their eyes, their Dharma eye, their eye of wisdom, open from this little hint of a statement? And for that, I think we have to look at the religious world of the time of the Buddha. These were smart, I would take them to be two smart people, who are deeply embedded or engaged in the reflection of what it means to be involved in a spiritual life, what it means to be a human being that existed in India at that time. And I like to think that back, maybe in the centuries before Buddha, was one of these, some point there was a time when humans, for the first time, started to become self-reflective. When we were monkeys, there wasn't that much self-reflection. At some point in the process of evolution, at some point, humans got increasingly self-reflective. And at some point, that self-reflection brought people to start realizing that I'm aware of myself, I'm aware I have thoughts, I'm aware I have history, I'm aware that I have choices I can make. And this ability to be self-aware, to the degree to which humans are, is very unique to our human life. And so many spiritual traditions point back to this capacity for self-reflection as being extremely important for the path, for the teachings. So as people started looking back, they realized they became very concerned about what is it that makes us happy? What brings welfare? What brings us the best conditions for our life? And so then there was a range of explorations and answers that were given to this question. One of the most ancient Indian answers to that question that we're aware of is the idea that our happiness and our welfare is dependent upon the gods. So if we pray to the gods, make sacrifices to the gods, please the gods, if they're pleased with us, they'll provide us with boons. They'll do something good for us. The crops will grow nicely or whatever. And so sacrifice was a big part of this ancient Indian tradition in order to please the gods. Not many of us sacrifice gods anymore. sacrifice to the gods. We've sacrificed the gods. But many of us, I think, still look not to gods for happiness, but sometimes we'll look externally for our happiness. Some people look to the government. It's up to the government. And people get very angry or upset because the government is not doing what they're supposed to do. Or they look towards family members, or to friends, or to employers, or to society, or to whatever. It's something else out there is the cause of my unhappiness and is responsible for making me happy. And if only the people in the world would participate, cooperate better, then things will go well for me. And I would suggest that that kind of approach is like trying to hope that the gods will take care of us. So then there was a movement of people who started becoming even more self-reflective and wanted to say, you know, maybe there's some, is there some personal responsibility, not just the gods, but other avenues or channels for causality, for cause and effect. And a number of different ideas arose. One idea was that no. whatever happens to us is predetermined, and there's nothing we can do about it except let it play out. So if we're suffering, we're suffering because it was predetermined back in the beginning of the Big Bang or whatever, and we just have to, you know, hang out there with the suffering until that particular spring unwinds, and then hopefully there isn't another suffering spring that has to unwind. You know, who knows why things... So that was one theory that existed. Another theory was that things are not predetermined, but that they are random. And so again, you can't have any impact on your life, but just things are happening randomly, and you're just kind of the victim of this random throw of the dice. Another theory is that things were predetermined to some degree, or maybe not predetermined, but set in motion in the past, maybe by your past karma. But then karma, once you set the momentum going by how you act, then that action has to play itself out. So if I, if I do something really terrible, that sets in motion a certain chain of cause and effect that has to play itself out. So if I steal, then perhaps maybe I have to go to jail if I get caught, or maybe I have to kind of live with a bad conscience for the next 30 years or something, or perhaps I get reborn as a worm, something, blue jay. The blue jay is good. And you're trying to steal people's lunches. So it has to just play itself out. And there's nothing you can do about it except not add any more karma to it. And so that was one theory. So people who had that idea tried to do as little as possible activity. Literally, and so they would go around, and if they walked around, they would have brooms, they would sweep the road in front of them, so they wouldn't step on any insects, because that was creating bad karma. And it would add to it rather than let it kind of dissipate. And they would sieve their water, so there wouldn't be any insects in the water when they drank. And eventually, the highest people took this to the nth degree, would actually starve themselves to death. Because to eat would be to somehow be involved in creating karma. So a variety of... So the question here is, what is it that brings suffering? What is it that brings happiness? What is it that's beneficial for us and for the world? And where's the responsibility lie? So when Sariputta heard... The Buddha teaches the cause of things and the cessation of that cause. How he interpreted it was that in this bigger context is that, things are not predetermined. Things are not set since they are. things are not kind of, you're not stuck in the way you are, but things arise because of particular causes, and those particular causes have an end. And if a cause has an end, then the condition that cause brings about will also have an end, is kind of the way it was taken. So so this is called the law of dependent co-arising. And this is one of the key teachings of the Buddha, that things arise in dependence on other things, and when those things that arise in dependence on stop, then, you know, so if X arises in dependence on Y, when Y disappears, X disappears as well. So these are things that arise in a conditioned way. When the cause and conditions dissipate, the result dissipates as well. This is so important that the Buddha said at one point, to see the Dharma is to see dependent co-arising. To see dependent co-arising is to see the Dharma. So to see, if you really want to see what the Dharma is, you have to see this principle, see how it works. In another place he said, so I'll leave it at that. So dependent co-arising. So in the place where the teaching of dependent co-arising is most highlighted, most emphasized, is around the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths is an application of this teaching of dependent co-arising. So there's something, the suffering, and suffering has a cause or a condition out of which it arises. It arises together with a condition. And what is that condition that suffering arises with? It arises out of the condition of grasping. Without grasping, without some kind of strong desire, there would not be suffering. It doesn't say that desire causes necessarily suffering, but without the strong desire, or thirsting or grasping, there would be no suffering. With the cessation of that grasping, there's a cessation of that suffering. So what it means, if you look at our suffering is not caused by the gods, whether it's the ones in heaven or the ones that we assign divinity to, the government or anybody else, our mother. But rather, there's something, it's not caused, it's not predetermined. It's not something we're stuck in. It hasn't always been that way. It arises out of causes and conditions. And so we start seeing those causes and conditions, and then we can gain, this is the important thing, it's possible to gain a degree of mastery over those causes and conditions. That we can become a player, an agent, to affect the nature of those causes and conditions. And a big part of what Buddha's training is beginning to get some kind of mastery over these causes and conditions, so that the responsibility is with us, not anywhere else. And we can make a difference. We can make a big difference. So the suffering, it's quite a challenge to hear these teachings, because some people's suffering and happiness, when we try to understand it, often in the context of a very busy, active mind or life. And it's hard to see the cause and conditions when everything's spinning really fast. But if we, part of what Buddhist training is, to get mastery over this, is to slow down enough so that we can see clearly the nature of these causes and conditions as they arise and pass. So we can see clearly enough. And this is not an unusual thing for humans to do, to slow down so we can see more clearly. If a friend comes to you who is troubled and wants your counsel, wants to talk with you, you don't continue cleaning your house furiously, and answer the phone and listen to them at the same time. You slow down and stop and listen. There are certain times when we can do a lot of different things, but other times when if you really want to give your friend due attention, you really want to slow down and really be present and give them a lot of time and presence. So something like meditation practice is doing the same thing for ourselves, is slowing down in a deep way so that we can really pay careful attention, really see what's here in a way that we can't if we keep being busy and running around. And I've seen in my own mind, I've kind of wondered, why am I suffering? Why am I unhappy? Why am I going on? And I keep being really busy, doing a lot of different things, and trying to figure it all out. And I'm perplexed by it. And then I sit down to meditate, and I calm down, and go, oh, that's what's going on. Now I see what it is I'm attached to, what I'm grasping at, what I'm preoccupied with, in a way I couldn't when I was so busy. So part of the process then of understanding dependent co-arising requires something of us, requires us to slow down enough or become strong enough with our attention to see. And one of the things we start seeing is how things arise and how things pass. How things arise not because they, and how they arise because of causes and conditions. And the most important thing that we want to see as Buddhists is the arising of suffering, of stress, psychological discomfort, to really take this in some deep, deep way. Just like you would for your friend who is disturbed, and you really want to be present for your friend in a deep way. And then you start seeing, what is, as you start slowing down and seeing, can we start seeing the momentum, the movements of the mind, the activities of the mind, and to see what kind of activity of the mind is useful and what is not useful in order to learn to take responsibility for our inner life. Taking personal responsibility is one of the key qualities of Buddhism, I would say. And it belongs, there's a lot of things in life where we have to take responsibility for ourselves. We can't expect someone else to do it. If you need to pee, you don't ask someone else to pee for you. It's pretty basic that you got to do it for yourself. If you want to exercise, you don't pay someone to exercise. it's a lot of work to exercise. I'm not going to bother. But it's a good idea here, so I'm going to pay for someone to exercise, It doesn't work, right? You got to do it for yourself. Education, you have to educate yourself. So Dharma practice belongs to that realm where we have to kind of require something of us. And without understanding that it requires something of us, I think there would be no Dharma practice at all. It's not just wishful thinking, it's not just being inspired, it's really turning the mirror and really looking deeply. And then looking deeply at all this stuff, starting to see what goes on, and then we start seeing how we relate to what's happening. So our relationship to our experience is a big part of the conditions that bring about a cause of suffering or happiness. So if I relate to my experience with generosity, that creates a different inner life than if I relate to my experience with greed. If I relate to my experience or my world or to people with kindness, that creates a different inner landscape than if I relate with hostility. If I relate with confusion, that creates a different inner landscape than if I relate with clarity or understanding. So as we start learning to pay attention more carefully to the inner landscape, what goes on, we train ourselves to notice, how am I relating to this right now? So if you notice we're relating with greed, what do you do about that? Only you can decide what you do about that. You can decide, well, no thank you. I think I'll let go of that movement of greed. I'll let go of that hostility. Or at least I'll set myself on a course of practice that can lead to me letting go of it. Or you can decide, it's not so useful to be greedy, but it is useful to be generous. I'll just wait until I'm struck by a lightning or struck by the inspiration to be generous. I'll just wait. That's one approach. Another approach is, why wait? You know, I can be generous. Please, let me try to exercise that muscle. As we begin getting a sense that we can have some mastery, some choice over how we relate, we can start relating in wiser and wiser ways. And we can start relating in ways that doesn't cause stress. So we are relating in ways where we don't cling or hold or resist as much to our experience. And the tenet or the axiom of Buddhism is that the suffering that we're interested in addressing is that suffering that arises out of how we relate. The condition, the cause for the suffering we're interested in is that we're interested in the cause and the cessation of the suffering that arises from a cause. Make some sense? So we look at what is that cause? What is the way we're relating? Some of the most difficult suffering we have in our life takes a lot of patience and a lot of care, a lot of compassion, a lot of time and dedication to develop the kind of inner stillness and inner compassion and kindness that can help us to see what it is. Our clinging to self, to self-identity, our clinging to comfort, our clinging to our opinions. It takes a lot of dedication to be able to come to a place where we see, oh, it's not to my best interest anymore to hold on to a self-image, to cling to that. It's not in my self-image to hold on to anything at all. So a part of the process of practice in Buddhism is usually is considered a gradual process of slowly learning to understand what goes on, to see clearly, and then learn to take some responsibility for this and learn to let go of those things that we see are unbeneficial for us and pick up those things that are beneficial. So we start letting go of that which is not beneficial. And what's beautiful about that statement, that idea, is that we're not asked in Buddhism to let go of anything until we see for ourselves that this is not useful. It also means that it's a gradual process, means that we're weaning ourselves of clinging. Some people have the idea that the Big Bang approach to Buddhism. You know, if I just kind of, it must be this key, this moment of insight, this moment of awakening, this moment, and then I'll be happy ever after, just take care of everything. Kind of magical thinking. That just there's this magical experience that just, and from then on, it'll all be taken care of. Sometimes enlightenment is the Buddhist god. You know, just pray to enlightenment enough. It'll do it for me. But I think generally in Buddhism, the idea is that it's a slow process, and slowly we begin to see the relationship we have. We see the relationships we have that aren't useful, the way to live, and we begin having some mastery or some choice over these causes and conditions that we live in, where we live in a sea of causes and conditions. It's not random, and it's not out of our control. We begin helping to shape those causes and conditions to some degree. And as we shape those causes and conditions, we shape them so that it improves our life, improves our heart, our mind. And we improve it so that we can see more clearly, have the calm and stillness enough so we can see. And when the mind gets calm and still enough, and we're no longer caught up in our usual attachments and concerns, not caught up in self-identity, then it's possible to find the core clinging, which out of which so much of our character, personality, experience of life is born or is shaped by. And then an amazing thing happens where we see that let go. And it's remarkable to have an experience where we see clearly that it's to our own best interest not to cling to anything whatsoever. And to really see that, wow, it's to my own best interest. And not only my own best interest, it's probably the best interest of my friends too, in the wider world, not to cling. And rather than clinging, being letting go of clinging being something frightening, it becomes something that is very inviting, very meaningful. And in fact, to have this experience of letting go of clinging so thoroughly that it becomes somehow a deep impression on the mind, it's not really possible to go back to investing our happiness in the world of clinging again. It's like, you know, that's, you know, there might be a tendency there, but when we think about it, we realize, you know, I'm not really going to invest in clinging anymore. The return is not so good. So, the teachings on dependent co-arising is considered to be the most profound teaching in Buddhism, because it's a teaching that things arise from a cause. With the cessation of that cause, those things pass away. When that's applied to suffering, suffering has a cause. When the conditions for that cause fall away, then that suffering goes away. To complete, kind of to restate this in a way for the Four Noble Truths, suffering has a cause or condition, which is in grasping. And happiness has a condition, and that is following a path of practice, the Eightfold Path. So usually this Third Noble Truth is called the cessation of suffering, but the flip side of that is happiness. So happiness and its cause, suffering and its cause, happiness and its condition, is what the Buddha taught. So we have about 5 minutes. If anyone would like to ask any questions for clarification or for protest, you're welcome to do that. Yes, Pat?
You used the phrase of, if you relate to the world through ill will or hatred, and there's a way to do the opposite of that. And the opposite of confusion was clear seeing. And at that point, I lost it because I don't understand. I understand if you're feeling ill will, then you generate compassion. But if you're feeling confusion, I don't understand
how you can just switch it like that.
Yeah, you just generate understanding.
Yeah, you touched on one of the Achilles heels of my talk. And it is possible. I guess, you know, Inez apparently gave a talk on delusion, right, last week. So you missed it. And it is possible to know you're deluded. But part of the problem of delusion is often we don't know it. And so then it's hard to kind of call up clarity. But sometimes there is foolishness and there is wisdom. And sometimes it's possible to get a sense, you know, that motivation of mine is pretty foolish, it's confused, it's deluded. You know, if I think that my happiness is going to come from winning the California lottery, or my happiness is going to come from giving a peace of mind to my neighbor, you know, there can be enough for self-reflection to realize, you know, I think that's maybe kind of, I've heard that there are other teachings. The wisdom teachings say differently. Maybe I should question, you know, the wisdom of, you know, maybe I'm deluded, or maybe I need to question more deeply why, you know, what my motivation is. Yes, please.
When considering the work on letting go of clinging to avoid suffering, I struggle with taking that to the next, or going, taking it too far perhaps, and getting to the point of not caring and not having an investment in an outcome. And I keep bouncing between those, because it seems like that caring in itself about an outcome and using that to engender a focus becomes a bad thing, as it is, as well as because it's an investment in, or a clingy investment. Just interested in your comment on that.
It's possible to have desire for things without clinging to the desire. It's possible to care for things without clinging to the outcome. To not care can often be a form of aversion. So it's not necessarily doing nothing, not having no desire at all, but often not caring about something is a distancing, an activity of the mind that has aversion in it. So we have to be very careful that in letting go of clinging, we're also not picking up aversion, because then you're in danger. You know, so indifference, for example, sometimes has aversion as part of it. My belief, my expectation, my experience is that as we let go of clinging or attachments, that it gives a pure expression to our compassion, our pure desire to be helpful, be of service, and it makes us more capable of caring rather than less. And if you're letting go of clinging makes you a less caring person, look more carefully at it. Now, there might be some conventional ways in which you might care less. The monk who was here last night, he couldn't care less what we thought of him. And the normal social ways in which people kind of connect to each other and are nice to each other and, you know, show that they care for each other. He wasn't interested one bit in that. But I think he cared a lot, otherwise he wouldn't have been here and he wouldn't have talked as much as he did. He was really trying to be helpful and connect. But he wasn't playing a lot of the usual social games that we kind of often do. So in an inadequate way, what I'm trying to say is that what caring looks like might change as we cling less. And there has to be some kind of maybe some readjustment. And it might look for a while that to some of your friends that you're not caring so much because they're used to you always relating a certain way. But they have to learn that you're caring in a different way now. Maybe not as demonstratively, or maybe not. Like some people show they care by worrying. You know, and so, you know, so some people, some families, you know, that's how you show you love people. You worry enough. You know, you say, oh, that he cares about me because he's worrying. And but at some point you stop worrying, and then they say, what's going on? You know, you don't care. Don't you care anymore? So does this answer your question adequately, or you want to ask again?
It's a fine job of creating more questions.
Well, there's a bad way of creating more questions and a good way of making questions.
Good way.
A good way? Do you want to ask more, or are you content for now?
Not ready for them quite yet.
Okay. So one more. Norman, the last one.
You just added more confusion to my delusionment. As you talked about changes, isn't there a certain degree of delusion from where you go from one aspect or one idea? Do you think your understanding to a change as you're beginning to either not care or become more impersonal about it? As you just stated that the monk last night could care less about what we thought about him, isn't that a sort of delusionment?
Delusionment? Is he
deluded?
Deluded. I don't know if that was still necessarily. I don't know him that well, so I can't really speak for him and what motivated him, his understanding, but how he was. I mean, it was kind of unusual, certainly. I think there's often changes that go about that we have that don't involve delusion, but rather maybe greater understanding. When we don't understand something well, it's easy to get caught up in it. And we understand better what's going on, we're not so caught. And so the example I give often enough is the difference between first-time parents and grandparents. They both care a lot about the child, but the first-time parents, every little scrape and whimper is like, you know, a major cause of worry. The grandparents have seen it all before, and they care, but their caring is not so worrisome or so caught up in every little detail. So there's a change that happens over time. And I don't think that change necessarily involves delusion. If I'm understanding, you want to ask again? Because maybe I didn't understand you.
That's my problem. I'm still confused about delusionment. And when is it not delusionment? You may have a certain understanding about what you feel that is a good change or a bad change, right. But where is the line where you're not delusion? It's not delusion for you.
Yeah. So one of the definitions of wisdom in Buddhism is to know what is beneficial and to know what is not beneficial. And so that's something hopefully we can see clearly. So when we're deluded, we're doing things that have understandings and doing activities which are causing harm. And hopefully we can see clearly at some point, wisdom sees clearly, well, this is harmful, this is causing affliction, and this is beneficial, this is not causing harm. And that can be seen. That's like... And if we try to understand, if the opposite of delusion is to some kind of grand philosophical truth about the nature of reality, that's maybe too hard to come to. The Buddhist idea of wisdom, I would like to suggest, maybe is kind of humble. It's not some grand understanding of philosophy or grand understanding of the nature of self or grand understanding of the nature of the universe. But rather is conditioned on this very simple ability to notice when we're suffering and when we're not, and then to be able to see, oh, this here is causing me to suffer. This is causing me not to suffer. And so that's where the wisdom and delusion is, how those are separated in Buddhism. Does that make sense?
Yes. At this point, anyway. I'll think about it a little later.
I'd be happy to... you know, to talk more about with you later at some point about it.
Thank you.
So, thank you all. And if you see dependent arising, you see the Dharma. If you see the Dharma, you see dependent arising. And so as you, those of you who stay for the potluck, I hope that you enjoy the food for your body and that... the company of your fellow community here becomes a wonderful Dharma food for your mind. Thank you.